Changing times with all its fleeting fads have left me in a spin. First it's in and really groovy, man, and just like that, it's out again. There is one I can depend upon. Jesus is his name. Yesterday, today, forever, he's just the same.
He never changes. He's the same.
The same.
How the world may play the game.
No matter how wrong you've been, how deep in sin, he loves you just the same.
He never
Welcome back, everyone, to the latest episode of the PresbyCast. I'm one of the hosts, Resbyterian. My co-host for the evening will be the usual Chortles Weekly, and we hope that you've had a very manageable and effective week as the calendar is barreling towards Festivus at a breakneck pace. If you have any grievances that you'd like to share with us, you can do so on December 23rd as we all dance around the pole. But until then, keep it to yourself or just go ahead and throw it to us on Twitter, hashtag AskPresbyCast. It's sort of become the compost bin of hashtags and questions and comments. Again, we've got a great special guest here for you tonight. I think we're all going to really enjoy this and hopefully come back to this podcast for a long time to come. And like I normally do, I'll let Chortles Weekly introduce our guest.
Well, good evening. And everyone knows that we love religious celebrities. So we couldn't find any, but we have a gentleman with us tonight. He's taught for 19 years at Westminster Seminary, California, and that's amazing because I didn't know anyone stayed at any seminary for 19 years anymore. It's a lack of ambition or that Midwestern groundedness. I don't know which it is. But our guest is R. Scott Clark, Dr. R. Scott Clark, who's a professor of church history and what else at Westminster Seminary?
Historical theology.
And historical theology. He is a minister in the United Reformed Church, the URC. We do love our acronyms around here, and we've threatened to do an all-acronym show because of complaints about the number of acronyms, but a URC minister and a former radio professional. Isn't that right?
That is correct.
Yeah, see? So that's intimidating in and of itself. But since we wear headsets, we don't have to worry so much about mic technique, so we'll muddle through. But he has of course, anyone that follows him on Twitter in the fall suffers with him through the Nebraska football season, the school of which he is an undergraduate. So if you may want to mute him in the months of September, October, November, because you live and die with him on there.
Well, if he's tweeting Nebraska in January, it means something really good happened. So,
let's hope.
It means we transcended mediocrity.
But anyway, he has an MDiv from Westminster Seminary, California, and a doctorate from one of the universities or colleges at Oxford. Where'd you study over there?
St. Anne's, Oxford. So, Mike. Okay. Yeah,
I've been inside Brasenose, which I think is one of the lesser colleges.
No, not at all.
Okay, well, so the fact that he has a doctorate from Oxford tells me that he's smarter than he looks, and even smarter than he sounds, and he sounds pretty smart. Because we hung out in Nashville a few weeks ago, and that was enjoyable.
And we for always, you at least.
Oh, yes, and
we chortled weekly.
Yes, we did. Well, we always like to tell our listeners what our guest, because we have the benefit of video and we can see each other. So we always like to describe the appearance of our notable guests. For instance, Dr. Clark, Daryl Hart was wearing he had a gold lamé smoking jacket with black satin lapels, and he had the monogram you know, the DGH monogram.
And yet no cat hair got on it.
Yeah, it's specially treated. But, of course, Dr. Clark, as he was in, you know, in Nashville, is wearing full cowboy regalia tonight because that's his look. So I'm sorry that none of you can see that. But, no, in Nashville you did have cowboy boots, and you wore what I could only describe as a cool shirt. And I was, you know, I was pretty impressed by the cool shirt that you were wearing. So, anyway.
Mrs. Clark picked it out.
Okay, well, I figured as much. So, bless her heart and all of our wives, no doubt. Now, I know that you've had some interaction on Twitter with our producer, Silent Topher. Of course, he's here with us, but he is silent. He's not a big fan of yours. He calls you Clarkmeister. He says that you and I retweet each other too much, and he says that your penchant for Chick-fil-A is gross, is how he says it. So is there anything you want to say about Chick-fil-A?
Actually, I'm eating less of it these days.
Okay.
I love Chick-fil-A. It has a place in my heart, but it's not as big a place in my gut anymore.
Well, you still have that healthy glow, so that's good. Well, we're all about the health of the local church and our denominations, because we are concerned about that. And I think some of our listeners are starting to get the idea that we always come back to the church and we talk about the church. And that's a concept that some independents and Baptists and people from non-confessional, connectional backgrounds, it's a little foreign to them. But we always do come back to the church, and you've done a great service to the church with your blog and with your books, but I think above all with the book Recovering the Reformed Confession. And that's the content of that book and some of the concepts in it are what we want to talk about tonight. Now, no doubt many of our listeners have read that book. Some of them may be Reformed because they read that book. But even if they haven't read it for a while, maybe this will be a good refresher. I had not read it until recently, but I knew all the concepts from your blog because I'd read it for years. But I'm glad I'm reading the book because it's definitely much better to get it all in one piece, as it were. My first thought for tonight was that we would talk about some more contemporary things. I was listening to the Heidelcast, your podcast, the other day, and we'll tweet links to all this. And everyone knows how to find you, so it shouldn't be a problem. But I was listening to Heidelcast 104, and you talked about the weakening of Reformed distinctives that were due to the fight against liberalism. We jettisoned all the, you know, the extra stuff, and we formed alliances, and that weakened confessional churches in some ways. And I thought we would start with that, but I think that's not a good idea. I think we need to talk about two of the most helpful concepts that we find in your book, Recovering the Reformed Confession, the quirk and the choir. And I'll let you, if you want to, run through those for us, and we'll have some questions. And before we start, let me ask you this. The quirk and the choir, it seems to me that they're almost a shorthand for idolatry and also for our tendency to want to be autonomous. We saw it in the garden. We saw it at the Tower of Babel. Abraham largely resisted those temptations, but then we saw it with Israel, with the golden calf and Israel's idolatry. In the New Testament, we see problems with the Judaizers and the Gnostics, and then the errors of the Roman Catholic Church, the innovations, mysticism, images, miracles, papal infallibility, all those things, and then the excesses of the Anabaptist. All those things, I think, can be summed up under your two concepts of the quirk and the choir. So tell me if I'm close to the mark there, and then tell us what the quirk and the choir are.
Certainly, both of them could end up in those places. But I think there are varieties of both. So there are varieties of quirk and varieties of choir. the fundamentally, the Quark, the quest for illegitimate religious certainty, has two aspects, one of which is to know things the way God knows them. Maybe we can boil it down and to say to it's the desire to know what we shouldn't seek to know. I think that's the most fundamental aspect of Quark, is the desire to know what we shouldn't try to know. And it's really a transgression of Deuteronomy 29:29. The secret things belong to Yahweh, our God, but the revealed things belong to us and to our children forever, that we may do all the words of this law. And there you see a fundamental distinction. There are some things that belong to God, and there are some things that are given to us to know. And Quark is my way of trying to get people to think about what it means to try to know those things that haven't been given us to know.
Now, how many? Have you ever counted how many times in the Institutes Calvin warns against speculation and warns us away from this quest for illegitimate religious certainty?
I have not counted, but he does it a lot.
And
so he does it frequently, and that was one of the things that sort of shaped my way of looking at these things. It took me a long time to sort of synthesize these ideas, but nothing I'm saying here is original to me. I think I'm just transmitting in, you know, shorthand ways things that we've been saying really from the very beginning of the Reformation. Don't try to know things that we're not supposed to know, that we can't know, we shouldn't try to know, whether it's Adam and Eve in the garden, you know, you shall be as God, or, you know, whether it's the exact moment at which God created the heavens and the earth, what, you know, what time of the year it was, as Bishop Usher had calculated, or any number of things, or exactly how to apply the Mosaic civil law in contemporary society. So you write a 3-volume, you know, magisterial work on the Institutes of Biblical Law, as Rush Dooney said. I mean, there are lots of manifestations of this desire for certainty. You know, what I want to do is try to get people back to what I think are Reformation basics, going all the way back to Luther, who distinguished between the theology of the cross and the theology of glory. And that's where Quark and Quire meet, because they're both species of the theology of glory. Whether it's the quest to have a certain kind of exquisite, immediate or unmediated encounter with the risen Christ, or whether it's a desire to know what can't be known, a desire to know things the way God knows them.
Yeah. When you talk about the theology of the cross and the theology of glory, and maybe we'll talk about this later, but it occurred to me tonight as I was preparing that, you know, some of our transformationalist brethren who think they can bring the eschaton in and see this great continuity between the heavens and earth that we have now and the new heavens and the new earth, that may be a species of the theology of glory, it seems to me. The old school and the older Reformed were much more modest about their hopes and expectations in that area, weren't they?
I think that's generally true. I mean, there were elaborate expectations at different times, and certainly Neo-Calvinism or Kuyperianism that developed at the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, occurs, you know, in a context in the 19th century, particularly coming to the end of the 19th century, at the after the rise of you know, Industrial Revolution, there was a general sense of expectation of progress, and that was widespread, you know, for Christians and non-Christians alike. And philosophy was heavily influenced, particularly on the continent, by Hegel. And Hegel is all about the future. It's all about eschatology. So in Hegel's view of history, God is sort of manifesting himself, working himself out through this dialectical process. You have one movement, you have an opposing movement, an antithesis. They clash. There's a resolution that's a synthesis. And the process keeps going as God sort of works himself out. everybody in the continent was influenced by Hegel to one degree or another, particularly in the German-speaking world, but also in the Dutch-speaking world, and so arguably Kuiper was influenced by that. And there's a kind of optimism about what we can do, you know, if we, whether it's institute the right mechanisms, or from a Kuiperian point of view, you know, bring to bear upon everything the lordship of Christ and applying the faith, you know, we can achieve certain outcomes. There were older in older Reformed theologies, there were periods of expectation of earthly glory periods, you know, whether it's the literal thousand-year millennium among historic premillennialists or a great spreading of the gospel on the earth in anticipation of Christ's return. But I think the 19th century sort of changed all that, materialized it in some ways. Eric Vogelin talks about, you know, immanentizing the eschaton, you know, bringing heaven down to earth and making it all material. Of course, that's what Marx is selling, an eschatology of earthly glory, if only we do certain things, and if only the proletariat, you know, finally triumph in the class warfare.
Now, let's talk, of course, you know, it should be obvious to everyone that Rome has been guilty of both the quirk and the choir. They certainly had a theology of glory because they practically ruled the world at one time. But papal infallibility and, you know, the magisterium certainly purported to give them a sort of certainty that maybe they couldn't rightfully claim.
Yeah, I think I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, even just seeing the current Pope now, it's funny. You know, I follow a lot of people on Twitter who are socially conservative but religiously Catholic, and it has been enjoyable, not in like a Schadenfreude sort of way, but just interesting to watch them try to square up this Pope with what, you know, the Pope is supposed to represent here on Earth. That suddenly they've got one who's almost shooting from the cuff, but at the same time, you know, supposed to represent this, you know, certainty, this Christ's vicar on Earth. I'm sure there's more than a couple people who are, you know, wondering what this is all going to spell out for them, or, you know, who may have doubts. I guess best case scenario is they have doubts in the papal infallibility, and maybe they make their way our way.
Well, I think there are connections. One of the reasons that evangelicals are migrating to Rome, you know, swimming the Tiber, is the same thing that drives people to become King James only types, or sure, theonomists, or in my view, you know, followers of Gordon Clark. Don't send me tweets. I'll just block you. I'll delete you. I don't want to hear about it. And if you come to the blog, I'll probably block you there too. So I've had that discussion 8 gazillion times. But, you know, people who think they know what God knows the way he knows it, the same spirit that animates that animates the desire to not to necessarily know, but to be in communion with somebody who does know.
Yeah.
Right. And that's what Rome offers. If you're being honest, if one is being honest, you know, one has to look at this Pope and see that he's clearly just making things up, and that he has a very casual relationship with historic Roman Catholic orthodoxy. And he's very much a Vatican II and post-Vatican II Pope. And it's making the Catholic or the Roman traditionalists very nervous. And if the converts would be honest, they should be nervous because they're more orthodox, they're more traditional, more Tridentine, you know, Neo-Thomist by far than the current Pope. But the reason people Pope from, you know, the SBC or from evangelicalism or even from NAPARC is because they need to be in a communion with somebody who knows. And it's that desire to know what can't be known. And, of course, if you're honest, you like John Henry Cardinal Newman, you get there and you find out that it's just a tawdry little business, and you just don't have the nerve to go back whence you came.
Right. Luther wanted to know that he was saved, and that was a good desire that he had. But he tried everything that Rome had to offer, and it, it didn't work for him.
And that's not illegitimate. To know that is not illegitimate. I mean, we're talking about people wanting to know what can't be known and who are animated, you know, and maybe who psychologically have to be right. That's been my experience of Corkers.
Things
can't be left uncertain. We have to nail everything down.
Do you think that, I guess trying to bring it more not in-house, but I guess concentric circle-wise, a little bit closer to our fold, do you think that's sort of the draw to, and I don't want to go down the big wormhole because we'll probably do episodes on this at a later date, but do you think that's sort of the draw to Moscow, Idaho, and Wilsonites with the Federal Vision, as far as, you know, they've got a central polarizing figure who's certainly writing, feeling like he's got some authority behind it, and they feel like there's a sort of certainty that they get there that they don't get anywhere else, that maybe they should?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I've known families to pack up and move to Moscow, and it's a little piece of heaven. It's a little piece of Christendom up on the Palouse in Idaho, and they have, as you say, an organizing figure, a personality. You said polarizing, and that's true, too. So he's both organizing and polarizing simultaneously, and they've got a soteriology that's unique to them that they've discovered. They've got... an approach to education that, you know, that they're either recovering or innovating, depends on what day you ask. And some people, I would never say this, but some people might even say plagiarizing.
Well, in the baptismal regeneration that we sort of see with their view of temporary salvation for baptized infants, that gives them a form of certainty as well.
No, sure.
It's not a great certainty because it's temporary, but we see it here too. So I think if people will use the framework of illegitimate certainty and illegitimate experience, it'll explain a lot of things in the religious world for us.
I worked out those categories precisely for that reason. You know, that's why I didn't give an exhaustive list. These are ways of looking at things. And I hope categories are baskets in which people can put things as they experience them. But I think that's absolutely right about Moscow. You're in. My child is elect, right? It's more than baptismal regeneration in the Federal Vision. It's baptismal union with Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And every baptized person receives all the benefits of Christ.
Thanks for answering that. Go ahead.
You have that until you resist. In that way, it's almost like confessional Lutheranism at that level. But at least with confessional Lutheranism, you're going to get a good law gospel sermon. And of course, in the Federal Vision, all you get is law. The gospel is you've been temporarily united to Christ, temporarily saved, temporarily justified, temporarily adopted. Now do your part to keep all of these benefits.
Now, hold on. I heard this week on Twitter that you were a Lutheran.
Well, when it comes to distinguishing law and gospel, all confessional Reformed people are Lutherans, and anybody who thinks differently doesn't know the tradition, doesn't understand the primary sources, and is just plain mule ignorant.
that quote, we may quote you on that sometime.
That could become a drop.
The evidence in the original sources is overwhelming.
Absolutely.
And I was driven to it by reading primary sources. Again, you know, Caspar Olivianus, whom nobody would confuse for a Lutheran, said in his commentary on Romans that the entire book of Romans could be reduced to one thing, and that is the distinction between law and gospel. And in it, he was not, as was recently claimed online by some learned online scholar, that by that, he did not mean merely a historical distinction between the old and the new, but he meant exactly by that what Luther meant by it, as he goes on to say, and as he says in many places, a categorical theological distinction between the principle of law, do this and live, and the principle of gospel, Christ has done for you. So he was intentionally mediating to Reformed readers exactly what Luther had done, exactly what Melanchthon had done, which was the common inheritance of all the magisterial Reformed.
Is Should we say anything else about the quest for illegitimate religious certainty, the quirk, before we move on? I mean, it occurs to me, you mentioned this earlier, and I was thinking about this today, that your KJV only independent fundamental Baptist, that's a species of quirk, I would think, or an example of it. Sure. What are, you know,
I'm surrounded by them.
Yeah. You mentioned theonomy as being one of them. Anything else that might be helpful to Reformed people or people who are Reformed curious, as we call them? What else is an example of Presby curious? That's another. He's turning red, folks.
I like that. Presby curious.
We've got a lot of Twitter followers who are transitioning.
Yeah. No, actually, I mean, I'm sure if I've gotten, you know, three messages from Baptists who are becoming, wanting to become Reformed, you've Absolutely. Gotten 1,000. You know what that's like.
Sure. There's 60 million evangelical Baptists in North America, and they need Reformed theology explained to them individually, one by one. I actually had a guy tell me recently, it doesn't count unless you tell me personally. And he wasn't being ironic. He was being serious.
So, well, to all the Baptists out there, I can assure you, Dr. Clark is speaking directly to you, and if you raise your hand, he can see that hand.
Yeah, I see that hand.
So, yeah.
The bus is away. All over the building. Come on down.
Everyone else's eyes are closed, but we can see your hands, guys. Yeah. It's okay.
Yeah, all heads down, every eye closed.
You know, as you talk about the quirk and the choir as helpful frameworks to explain what we see. When I was as I always say, a dumb Southern Baptist, when I came across a book funded by the Dendalk Foundation, that is. A book called Southern Baptists and the Doctrine of Election, it immediately explained for me the concept of election. It explained to me what was wrong with our system of invitation and crisis and everyone being happy that this person went through this crisis and did something, but then nothing changed. It explained all the problems and the errors of the evangelistic and invitation system that they used, the light just came on. So I think the quirk and the choir can function in a similar way for people.
Let me add one more thing, and so that the listener knows what he's looking for. The quirker says this: I am right, I think X, ergo X is right. the quirker is, if he's impenitent, is a narcissist. The world sort of revolves around him. And so where in some cases you hear people saying, you know, I know what God knows the way he knows it, what they really mean is God knows what I know the way I know it. If you understand that, you'll understand why it's so difficult to break out of that and to abandon that construct. Because I am at the center, right? I am right. And, of course, that's the premise that has to be questioned. I think X, well, there's, you know, that's not in doubt. But the first premise is what's in doubt. But that's the premise that no quirker can really afford to be challenged. The quirker's certainty, his assurance, doesn't rest, and this is, I'm being serious now, doesn't rest so much on Christ and his finished work and Christ's word in Scripture to us, the promises made in the gospel and in the sacraments. It rests on his being right about X, whatever X is. And so in that sense, the quirk is a really serious problem. And it does really afflict the Reformed world. And it's something that we need to address. We need to be honest about the fact that we have it. It's in our circles. And the quirker can really drive out, for example, visitors when they come to church.
Yeah.
You know, a visitor comes to church and they're beset immediately by three, you know, and Resby will forgive me, bearded, or beardos, as I heard recently. right?
No with, offense taken, with, trust me.
With pocket protectors and their copies of, you know, Clark Speaks from the Grave, not this Clark, but Gordon Clark, and, you know, they want to know, is this person a follower of Gordon Clark, or is this, or the other one's got a copy of Rush Dooney's Institutes of Biblical Law, or Bonson's Theonomy and Christian Ethics, or, you know, I recently had to ban a King James only guy from the Heidelblog. I mean, whatever it is, whatever the hobby is, and they set upon these visitors, instead of welcoming them and inviting them into a community where they'll be loved and where they'll be encouraged by the gospel and so forth, they found a collection of, you know, weirdos and losers, it looks like, anyways, from the outside world. You know, if you come out of a congregation where there's a praise band and everybody, you know, dresses casually but nicely, and you come into some Reformed congregations, it's a huge culture shift. And then you add the quirk to that, and then you wonder, well, why are our churches 50 people, and not 500 people?
Well, of course, you have a line parked in the parking lot of 1978 15-passenger cargo vans, yep. with a quiver full and lots of little fish on the back. That can be off-putting, too.
Right next to the high-hater mobile.
Yeah, don't bring my vehicles into this.
Yeah. So. Well, somebody has to, because one of them's missing a wheel and it's sitting up on the sitting up on blocks in your front yard.
That's normal where I live, Dr. Clark.
It's normal where I grew up, so those are my people.
Many mobile homes with cars that aren't.
Yeah. Yes, no doubt. Well, so we're about halfway into this hour, and we've moved through the quirk, which is probably the simpler part of this to look at, and probably the more, we can do it more succinctly. But let's move to the second part of the second concept, and that is the choir. Of course, there are some quirky choirs. That's not what we're talking about here. The choir, the quest for illegitimate religious experience. This is more self-evident for us. And, of course, if we think about some Pentecostal or Anabaptist excesses, it's pretty easy to see what you're getting at. But there's much more to it than that. And, you know, there are some revered figures in the Reformed-ish world, a Calvinistic world, that would adopt and promote ideas of experience that you might consider to be unwise. So just go ahead and say what you'd like to say to introduce that concept of the choir.
Let me quote Ben Myers, and I had this on the blog some years ago, and he described the choir, I think, better than I ever did. He says, "Where every church service becomes the opportunity for a life-changing experience of the divine presence, where every song and sermon and prayer is designed to produce immediate emotional impact, where the whole Christian life is transformed into the pursuit of a naked experience of the divine, here the final outcome can only be a profound and paralyzing boredom. And for those subjected to such boredom, the only remaining spiritual desire is for a mysterious God, a God not merely naked and exposed, but clothed in ritual, sacrament, and tradition." And I think he just absolutely nailed it. What the choir is, paraphrase Bill Clinton, what the choir is, it all depends on what is. What the choir is, the desire to encounter the risen Christ nakedly, without mediation, without the word, without the sacraments, without the preached word. It's in some ways quintessentially American.
But let's talk about the historical precedence for that, because Rome is all and. Choir is not absolutely a synonym for mysticism, but it's pretty close, right?
It's pretty close, yeah.
So the Roman Church, and I'm sure the early church, I mean, we know that there were heinous errors in the first century even, But as the Roman Church developed, you had phony miracles, relics, the appearances of Mary, bleeding paintings and statues, and you name it. Have you ever read? It was in. Have you read the book by Carlos Iyer, War on the Idols?
War Against the Idols. Yes.
Yes, War Against the Idols. There's an account in there of one of the reformers as a child going to a Roman shrine, and the account of it just terrified the kid, and there's nothing new under the sun.
Well, I mean, to their credit, and not that I'm defending any of that, but at least in Rome, as most people experienced it most of the time, there was actually a kind of mediation. You know, God is mediated to you through the priest. He's mediated to you through the sacraments. He's mediated to you through the images. You know, now some of that is just plain idolatrous, right? We don't have to discuss that too much. But I'm really talking about the Anabaptists and the mystics, whether it was Bernard of Clairvaux, whom I call and others have called a Christo mystic, that is, his mysticism is oriented around the person of Christ, and evangelicals have resonated with that, or the ontological mystics who tended to predominate in later medieval theology, where Christ is sort of marginalized in favor of just being absorbed into the divine being. The Anabaptists were profoundly mystical. They were all about an immediate revelation. What a lot of people don't know is that what we know as Pentecostalism or the Charismatic movement really comes out of the Anabaptists in the 1520s. They were the original Pentecostals, at least relative to us. I mean, right. There were proto-Pentecostals, in a sense, as early as the 3rd century. And they reappeared periodically through the history of the church. But the Anabaptists did many of the things that we associate with Pentecostalism, you know, from the Cane Ridge Revival in the early 19th century, or the Topeka and Azusa Street Revivals in the early 20th century, or Third Wave Pentecostalism, what have you. The speaking in tongues, the getting of receiving of revelations, the giving of prophecies, alleged miracles, etc. All of that stuff was taking place among the Anabaptists, and so they really symbolized this quest for to encounter God nakedly apart from the Word. They ridiculed one of their leading I was going to say theologians, I suppose that's right. One of their authorities, Thomas Munzer, used to mock the Reformed as ministers of the dead letter because they were devoted to the Scriptures as the sole source of saving revelation from God. And he boasted that he didn't need the Scriptures. In fact, he said the Scriptures only become the Word existentially when it becomes the Word to him subjectively. In other words, he, in some ways, anticipated Karl Barth's view of Scripture. That really, I think, sets the contrast between the magisterial Protestant view of Scripture as the locus, the place where God reveals himself, over against the subjective experience of the divine. There was a person commenting on the blog today saying how she, you know, regularly receives divine revelation, and she doesn't seem, at least at this point, to have any consciousness of the enormity of what she's saying.
Right.
But as we move from the medieval and the time of the Reformation into the American period, the colonies, and then and beyond, I guess we had the Quakers there who would have something, would be experiencing something like this. But the ways that this illegitimate experience influenced the more normal churches and the Reformed and Reformed-ish churches were more subtle, and a lot of that seemed to revolve around a revered figure by many Reformedish or Calvinistic people, and that would be Jonathan Edwards. And, of course, we hear that he was a boring guy, and he read his sermons in monotone and kept his finger in the pages and turned one page at a time. But I know he's a revered figure to many, but you're not the only one to say that his influence was not entirely helpful in this way. So what can you say about Edwards?
I actually have a quote from RRC, if Dr. Clark would permit me.
Go for it.
And I really love this one. I had this kind of double bracketed in there. Finally, it is difficult for those who identify with Reformed Orthodoxy to criticize Edwards because many American Calvinists agree with his theology, or at least they think they do. One suspects, however, that confessional Reformed folk might not be so ready to identify with Edwards' theology if they understood its debt to modernity and specifically to certain forms of rationalism and idealism. And, you know, on a personal note, I actually have not read any Jonathan Edwards. It was something always seemed off, and I decided to put it off for, you know, another day, another day, another day. You know, I have yet to regret that decision, and I'm sure that I will delve in at some point. But, you know, this particular section coming up and being surrounded by a lot of Edwards-loving people really stuck out to me.
Well, my argument is that religious affections it does not represent a traditional Reformed theology, piety, and practice. I think it's a peculiarly 18th century way of doing Christian or Reformed piety. I don't think that Owen or Perkins or, you know, Willabius or any of our guys, Calvin, would have or did write religious affections. And so one of the things I hope people will do is to understand that Edwards is something of an outlier as we look at the whole history of Reformed theology. Reformed theology didn't begin in the 18th century. And Edwards didn't just drop out of the sky, and he isn't just another Puritan. However, Edwards is a creative theologian. He's much more heavily influenced by Platonism than many people understand. He was an occasionalist in the way that he viewed the relationship between God and the world. Charles Hodge, again, as I always say, send your cards and letters to Charles Hodge. I didn't say this. Charles Hodge, who's not known for hyperbole, called him a pantheist. And so that should give any Orthodox Reformed person pause, right? Spinoza is a pantheist. We think of pantheism as a great heresy, right? It violates fundamentally a basic Christian conviction, which I call the categorical distinction. That's the creator-creature distinction. God is one thing and we are another.
Yeah.
And so pantheism obliterates that distinction. That's a very serious problem. And then, of course, and again, if the listener is an Edwardsian, or, you know, if Edwards is your homeboy, I'm sorry if this if this hurts you in some way, and I don't mean to be hurtful, but time is limited, and so we sort of have to get right to the punch. There are serious problems, or at least questions, about Edwards' doctrine of justification. And Edwards scholars have known this since the 1950s, but it's kind of a dirty little secret in some ways. Thomas Schaefer wrote an essay in 1951, I think, where he began to raise questions about Edwards' doctrine of justification, and there's a great body of literature that's developed, mostly, I think, in defense of Edwards, but there are serious questions remaining about Edwards' doctrine of justification. And I think, to be perfectly fair about it, I think anyone on either side of this question would have to say that at least Edwards is ambiguous. And from my point of view, anybody who is ambiguous about justification is highly problematic. Because John Calvin is not ambiguous about justification. Martin Luther is not ambiguous about justification. If you go through our magisterial documents, they're not ambiguous about justification. The Heidelberg Catechism, the Westminster Standards are perfectly clear about justification. The Belgic Confession are perfectly clear. So if a fellow is ambiguous, that's problematic and gives one reason for pause. Richard Muller, who gave the inaugural lecture at the Edwards Center at Trinity, has offered his judgment as well, that I think we've reached similar conclusions. And basically, Edwards is an outlier, that he's not really a part of the mainstream of Reformed theology. And what happens in American evangelicalism is he often becomes an entry point for people, and so they begin to use him to leverage the whole Reformed tradition.
You know, and I'm close to someone who's a big fan of Edwards, and I think this person is very is an intelligent person, and they're impressed with his intellect and his ability to reason, and he was creative. But creativity is not a terribly desirable trait in a theologian. And of course, Edwards has many supporters now, especially among the Baptist wing of the New Calvinists. But I think some of them are ignorant of some of his deficiencies. And probably it's not a real popular, well-funded area of study, I'm guessing, to down Jonathan Edwards. But
I think people hear Pastor John in Minneapolis talk about him, and they say, well, if John Piper thinks he's okay, then he must be okay. Which it might be a little harsh, but I've seen it in other things, so it's certainly possible for it to be that way too.
I do think the new Calvinist movement, right, is heavily indebted to Edwards, and it seems to me to be pretty broadly Edwardsian in its outlook, and that is something I think that has to be faced and addressed. So if the listener is part of the new Calvinist movement, that's great. It's not a bad place to start, but it's a terrible place to stop. It's like an on-ramp on the freeway. Right, you use the on-ramp what it's intended to do, or you use it the way it's intended to be used, and you don't stop on it, or you're going to get rear-ended. So keep going and get up on the freeway, and of course, from my way of thinking, that freeway is confessional Reformed theology, piety, and practice. And so one of the things I argued in the book is that if you even look at the way Old Princeton related to Edwards, they sort of shied away from him, and by the time you get to the end of the 19th century, early 20th century with B.B. Warfield, there's relatively few references, and others have noted that. I think I got that from Mark Knoll, not claiming originality. And I thought that was a very interesting observation, so that Hodge is sort of moving away, and A.A. Hodge, and then Edwards, or then Warfield and Machen. None of them particularly Edwardsian, all of them rather more confessional in their orientation. But the essence of the choir isn't really Edwards. It's this desire to have the immediate encounter, which most often manifests itself in a desire for religious euphoria. You know, when people say, we really worshiped today, you laugh because you've heard that a million times.
All been there.
And what they mean by that is, we had a particularly intense euphoric experience.
Normally connected to music.
Sure, and we could call this the quest for illegitimate religious euphoria, too. And I remember a guy who's a dear friend of mine, who when he was becoming Reformed, leaving fundamentalist dispensationalism, said to me, he said, I know that I should go worship in a Reformed church, but I feel like I'm hooked to the contemporary songs. And the minute he said that, I realized that he had said something really profound, I think, because he actually was. Here's my theory, my amateur psychological theory. Right? You go to a service, and the worship team's got it all planned out, and if they do their job, you get a rush of dopamine or whatever it is, you know, like a runner's high. And it's the job of the worship leader to sort of stimulate that release of dopamine. And that is an addicting thing. I mean, I used to be a fairly serious distance runner. And I remember the first time I ever had a runner's high. I actually got lost over by the penitentiary, and it was dark and it was raining. So I didn't think it was a good idea to quit running, so I just kept running. And eventually
like running.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Run, Forrest, run. So I kept running, and boom, I had the runner's high. And it was wonderful. And, you know, you feel like you could run forever, and so I just kept going. And then, of course, you run the next day to try to have that same experience. And people, you know, have written about this and experienced it. We're going through the same thing, I think, relative to worship. And
I can vouch for that. I used to run the soundboard for those experiences.
All right. So it's really a kind of our quest climbing up to God and you know, sneaking behind Moses, as it were, and the 70 elders at the top of the mountain to see God. And the truth is, in worship, God comes to us, and he clothes himself, as Olivianus said, in the covenant of grace. He clothes himself in the preached gospel. He clothes himself in the sacraments. And it's our job in worship to receive, not to climb, not to achieve, and not even to experience euphoria. And again, that goes back to the theology of the cross versus the theology of glory.
Yeah, we've talked about Edwards, of course, and what some people call the first pretty good awakening. I may not be willing to say it was all pretty good, but out of that grew what we call revivalism. So the part of this choir that has had a huge warping and changing effect on Reformed, we would call revivalism. So it didn't start and end with Edwards. It morphed into something more, you know, lowbrow and wide ranging. Of course, when we came to Finney and a number of, you know, who began as a Presbyterian but who never really was, but then some Presbyterian-ish evangelists and others that took some of these things and ran with them. So describe for us the effects of revivalism on the confessional Presbyterian and Reformed churches in, you know, in the last 200 years.
Well, in a strange way, it's also a species of rationalism. I mean, ostensibly, formally, it's irrationalism, it's subjectivism, it's God as I experience him, sort of trumping objective reality. But I was talking to a pastor today, and it dawned on me as we were talking that if you consider the Descartes in the 17th century, what is he famous? Well, one of the things for which he's famous is sort of setting up a mechanical universe. And what is the Second Great Awakening? It's the methodism or a mechanical approach to Christian piety. And the alternative to that, of course, is confessional Reformed theology, piety, and practice, in which we revel in the mysterious work of the Holy Spirit through the due use of ordinary means. But what Finney set up was a mechanism, a machine. You put all the pieces in place, and if the mechanic or the engineer does things correctly, then you pull the handle, and out comes the assured result. And that's what Finney did in his lectures on revivalism. And it had a powerful effect. It really swept the field in the 19th century in American religion, all across the plains and across the northeast part of the United States, such that there was a burned-over district in upstate New York. And it transformed American religion, and it became the paradigm, really, for American evangelicalism. So if you're in a typical evangelical church in America, you're probably the recipient, if you will, of the Second Great Awakening. You may not know it. Nobody's telling you this, but the reason you do what you do is because of the Second Great Awakening. The reason you have a worship team and a praise team, and the reason that the chord progressions are the way they are and everything is structured the way it's structured, it all goes back to Charles Finney. He laid it out very openly, very plainly, and he said, you know, if you do this, you'll get the results. It had such a huge effect that it's even very much influenced New School American Presbyterianism, and so you'll see it in ostensibly confessional Reformed and Presbyterian churches. It even affected Abraham Kuyper. A couple of years ago, I was reading the biography of James Bratt's wonderful biography of Kuyper, and he recounts the story how that 12 years after Kuyper had embraced Reformed confessionalism sort of out of liberalism, He attended some higher life meetings in Brighton, England, led by Robert Pearsall Smith and Hannah Whitehall Smith, and he became, at least for a time, a proponent of the higher life, sort of second blessing theology. So it even happened to Abraham Kuyper. That's how pervasive the influence was of the sort of 19th century Second Great Awakening revivalism. And it's dominated American evangelicalism through the 20th century, and it continues to influence it very much into the early 21st century.
Yeah, it reminds me, the first thing that came to mind when you kind of mentioned the whole idea of the formulaic action leading to a desired result, I guess it was almost a few years ago now. It's hard to believe that much time has passed, but thinking about when Elevation Church, when they had that little controversy over the spontaneous baptism manual that somehow leaked from their church, and it was this idea that, you know, this large mega church in near Charlotte would have what they were calling spontaneous baptisms, and yet there was an internal manual about how there were kind of plants in the audience where if they weren't getting enough people going forward so as to push more people to go forward to receive baptism, that they would have these plants who would sort of the first snowballs that would eventually create a larger avalanche. And, you know, just this, you know, again, this all done, you know, the ends justify the means, I'm sure was their justification for it. It was like, yeah, you can say all this, but look at how many people we baptized. You know, look at the numbers. How could they go wrong? You know, and they don't seem to have a putback when you say, like, well, Joel Osteen's church is, you know, tens of thousands, and I don't think anyone would say that he's, you know, preaching any sort of gospel whatsoever.
Well, that's right. It, you know, the idea that the Holy Spirit, you know, needs help, that we have to prime the pump, you know, that's widespread in American revivalism, and Billy Graham is said to have done that, where yeah. People are, you know, instructed to come forward, and these are people working, right? They're sort right. of the catchers in the thing. They come down, but it looks like they're responding to the altar call.
Yeah, and they're dressed normally, and
it's sort of they don't have uniforms on. They don't look like ushers, staff members, and they're counselors, and it sort of primes the pump and it gives people the courage to get up and do what needs to be done.
Vince McMahon does that quite a bit, if that tells you anything about the technique.
Yeah. So, well, if it's in wrestling, it has to be good.
Yep.
Well, I mean, there are some real connections between, you know, wrestling, as we used to call it, mm-hmm. and revivalism. I mean, I mean, if you think about a wrestling match, you know, as a 19th century revival, and these, you know, wrestling matches used to be held under tents, mm-hmm. right? So you've got circuses, wrestling matches, and revivals all held under tents, all with a sawdust, and each of them with a certain degree of showbiz,
right?
And entertainment, and everybody at a certain point, particularly in the 19th century, kind of knowing what the deal is,
right?
You know, after a while, after revivals come through your town a few times, you kind of know what the deal is. The guy, you know, and it's sort of an entertainment.
Absolutely. It's something the whole county, the whole area turns out for, and you see people you don't normally see.
Yeah, and the same fella goes down the sawdust trail to the anxious bench and so forth. So it again, this way of thinking about piety is still alive. I have to go back here. I can't find the quote. In 2012, Tim Challies put up a piece about the Lakeland revival that I thought captured what the choir is. And part of the quote says, "The revival was marked by what were said to be great manifestations of the work of the Holy Spirit, speaking in tongues, ecstatic prophecies, miraculous healings, and even the claim that somewhere around 30 people had been raised from the dead." And this is the kind of stuff that we've been hearing from the Second Great Awakening types since the early 19th century, but particularly since the middle of the 19th century. B.B. Warfield wrote a book on this, challenging these sorts of claims, and I think quite rightly so. But you know, this is a more extreme version. But this is really what American religion is. That's why you've got Joseph Smith. I mean, you just go through the rogues gallery of 19th century cult leaders, Christian Science, Seventh-day Adventism. They're all born about the same time. Jehovah's Witnesses, they're all a product of the Second Great Awakening, this sort of generalized religious fervor. And we're still living with the consequences of that. And so that shapes the paradigm for most American evangelicals and for a lot of Reformed and Presbyterian people as well. And the alternative, of course, is something rather simple, I hope more dignified, stately, something that's decent and orderly, and that is a structured service in which the minister leads us through a kind of liturgy of call and response, where the Lord speaks to us from his word and the people respond if we're doing it properly, right? If you're doing it right, we should be responding to him with his own word, which is sufficient for public worship. And that structures our worship. And God speaks to us in the law, we respond with confession of sin. He speaks to us in the gospel, we respond with praise and thanksgiving. And that's the alternative. It's not nearly as sexy, nearly as exciting, doesn't create nearly the dopamine release. But I don't think, frankly, dopamine has much to do with Christian worship, because ultimately worship's not about us. It's about the risen Savior and about him coming to us in his word and in his sacraments and about us receiving that once again every Sabbath.
Amen to that.
And what you should be hearing now is the next, 20 minutes of our interview. We had a nice wrap-up with Dr. Clark. We had another quote in there. It was really great, but much like in theologians, the ambitions get the best of our silent producer, or potentially soon-to-be ex-silent producer Topher, and Chortles Weekly's audio cutout, and we have very little usable audio from the rest of it. So please direct your tweets and your rage about this to @silent_Topher on Twitter. He'll be happy to take all of the complaints and comments and feedback about this episode. Really, the more honest you can be, the better. But, maybe we'll try to go in and see what we can find. There might be a couple more gems in there. But for now, we hope you enjoyed that hour with Dr. Clark. We sure did. Check out his blog at heidelblog.net. Dr. Clark is also on Twitter @rscottclark. Don't forget about our Twitter, which is @presbycast, @chortlesweekly, @resbyterian, and you can find a link to the Tetzel Boutique if you are interested in supporting our podcast, which, as Chortles said in a previous cast, we basically use that to send t-shirts to our guests, and we want to make sure that that they get something and that our brand expands, as it were. So go out there, enjoy the rest of your week, make fun of some anonymous comic book heroes, and if you get a chance, drop us a line, and we hope you enjoy this podcast. Thanks. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back.